We've been using the seven branch prayer or seven branch practice more and more in our practices, Green Tara, and in the regular meditation sessions sometimes, and also in our Bodhisattva study group. And so, like all of the practices that we do, this one really has two intentions. One is to accumulate merit and wisdom. That's the causes and conditions to allow us to progress or awaken. And then the other purpose of all the practices that we do is to remove the obstacles to progressing in merit and so therefore to progress in awakening. And this is no different. So that's why it shows up at the beginning of a practice like Green Tara, so that we can accumulate the energy, the blessing to do this practice, the understanding, the intention to cultivate that, and also to counterbalance any obstacles that we have that would prevent us from cultivating what it is we're trying to cultivate. So I'll read for you now a version of the seven branch prayer, which is from the words of my perfect teacher. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merits of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until samsara ends and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate the merit created by myself and others to the great enlightenment. So the seven branch prayer, the seven branches are prostration, unlike prostrations when we do refuge in bodhicitta, offering, confession, rejoicing, requesting to turn the wheel of Dharma, requesting not to pass into nirvana, and the dedication of merit. So one way to understand these is as antidotes for problems that arise that are obstacles in our practice. So, for example, prostrations are the antidote to pride. So prostration in Tibetan is chuksal, chuksal. Chuk means to sweep away, and sal means to recede. So what do we mean by pride here? Pride is a kind of self-importance. The pride is thinking that you are better than your peers, or better than other people, better than those who are great. There's also kind of subtle pride, which is the pride of thinking, I exist, I am, you know? So the minute that we have that little drop of pride, I exist as a separate and independent entity in the universe, then there's a kind of sense that if there's an I, there has to be other. And if there are other, then the whole game of life must be about winning over the other. There's a kind of other pride, I don't know what to call it, maybe blatant pride, which is thinking that you have better qualities than you actually do. So pride in something that maybe doesn't even exist. And there's also this other kind of pride, which is, I think, interesting, and it took me a long time to understand or to for this one to occur. And that's the pride of thinking that you're slightly inferior, really maybe inferior altogether. So how could that possibly be a form of pride? But it's actually a kind of pride because it's a focus on self-cherishing. So it's still grounded in the false belief that this self is a thing and in an independent, discrete entity. You know, that I exist in the way that I think that I do. And then there's a pride when which is taking pride in things that are actually a fault. I remember once Lama Michael said, he was talking to a group of us, what is your primary, most important virtue? And so everybody thought of that, you know, we thought a little bit. And then he said, okay, now ask yourself the question, is there a way that that could actually be a deep fault? I was so shocked because the minute that I thought of this thing as a virtue, you know, one of many virtues of mine, and then I also thought, oh, when he said, could it be a fault? I thought, you know, a dozen ways, not only that it could be a fault, but that it was a fault of mine. So let's talk about doing prostrations as an antidote to pride. The instructions for doing prostrations are to put your hands together, to place them at the crown of your head, and then your throat, and then at your heart. And this is to purify the obscurations of body, speech, and mind. Now, this really sets an intention, doesn't it? And then you touch the floor with your body at 5 points, the forehead, the palms of the two hands, the two knees. And this is purifying the obscurations of the five poisons and attaining the body blessings and the speech blessings, mind qualities and activity blessings. It's also said that when we bring our body to the ground in a prostration, that we purify the five poisons and we receive the blessings of the five kayas and the five wisdoms. So this is another way to think about it. So the second of the seven branches is offering. Offering is the antidote to miserliness or greediness. So offering is generosity, the first of the six paramitas. So if intense greed is one of the things being antidoted, what do we mean by that? Well, because of our attachment, we're not actually able to enjoy the things that we have. We cling to them and we're not willing to give them up or share them with other people. And so there's a kind of element of fear or grasping energy that they bring into our life. And so to antidote that, we fill the entire world, all of space, with the offerings of human and celestial realms. So we may have made offerings on our shrine. Those are, you know, the quote, actual, unquote, offerings. And then we also imagine flowers and incense and lamps and perfumed water and food and palaces, abodes of all kinds, mansions, landscapes, gardens. And then we could imagine in more advanced practice the eight auspicious symbols with the 16 Vajra goddesses dancing and singing, each one playing her own particular musical instrument. So sometimes when you read, you're offering the noble Samantabhadra's cloud banks of offering, it's talking about that very extensive offering. So we offer whatever we can. And when we do this practice, of course, what we encounter is a sense of, well, I'm not so sure I have wealth. How could I offer that? But then one might ask the question, if you are alive, if you have a body, if you have encountered the Dharma, are you not wealthy? So we offer the wealth that we have, and we also, the instructions sometimes say that we mentally offer all the wealth, even the things which belong to other people and also the things that have no owner. And then we make an offering of that. So this is meant to be super expansive practice. You can accumulate exactly the same merit if you would offer all of those things or your own possessions. I mean, if you actually gave them up. So never think that I have nothing to offer, I have so little to offer. Don't increase that kind of mind by that storyline. think about expansiveness and what can be offered. This will change the way that you think about what you have, what is yours, and your wealth and blessings in your life. There's another practice, you know, whenever you see something, like the other day I was listening to the wind and I thought it's so beautiful. In the moment of thinking I have something beautiful or I experience something beautiful, you can offer that to all beings or you can offer that to the guru. And so it develops this habit of not clinging. So it's the antidote to clinging. The antidote to stinginess. So right away when we feel, oh, I've had this beautiful thing, we let go of it. We train ourselves to do that just automatically by offering it. And of course, what you notice when you do that is you didn't have less after you offered. That's a very important teaching. So let that be your first thought when you experience something, whatever is beautiful, whatever is tasty, whatever is wonderful to experience, offer that and offer it to the three jewels or to your teacher, anything. It doesn't matter exactly who the recipient is. So the third of the seven branch prayer is confession. Confession, and this is always kind of interested me, is an antidote to anger. So what do I mean by confession? We're not confessing to God here. This is different in Buddhism. We are acknowledging and owning or admitting the things that we've done that were harmful, and we're taking responsibility for both what it was that we did or even thought or said. Taking responsibility for that, and we're also taking responsibility for any resulting harm that happened. So confession is acknowledging that, and we sometimes use this framework for this called the Four Powers. So these are the methods of confession. The Four Powers, which are sometimes also called the Four Strengths, are the essential elements in this sequence of confession as explained in the Vajrasattva practice. So if you're doing Nundro, this may seem familiar to you. The first of the four powers is reliance. So this is reliance on the transformative power of Vajrasattva, your own true nature, or the clear light nature of your mind. And do you think this reliance on that, I rely on that, the truth of that, to clarify this thought or speech or action that I had, which was harmful, unskillful. So we're just saying, I don't have to think that I can correct this myself entirely. I can rely on the Dharma for that, the power of the Dharma. The second of the four powers is regret. Regret is really, once you've acknowledged what it was that you've done, regret is understanding the consequences of those negative actions for yourself, for other people, for the environment, for the energetic fields in your life. They cause a kind of sickness, you could say, suffering, definitely. And they're absolutely contrary to the way of practice, the way of no harm, the way of peace. So the four powers so far, reliance and regret. And the third one, and this is absolutely essential, actually all of these are actually, is resolve. And resolve means I decide right here, right now, not to repeat that pattern. I resolve to look for it. I resolve to attend to it. And I resolve not to do this again. And then the fourth power, which is kind of interesting and action-oriented or activist-oriented, is remedy. Through remedy, we're looking at positive actions as an antidote to both the habit itself and a kind of antidote, a kind of karmic antidote, but also remedy, how would I say this? Remedy is a kind of planting the right seeds. So if we've done something wrong, something harmful, then we plant certain kinds of karmic seeds. And a remedy is to plant virtuous seeds, positive seeds, seeds that lead to the results that we want in our practice and our life. So the next of the seven branches is rejoicing. This is a wonderful practice. Rejoicing is the antidote to jealousy. And so, and I want to be clear that you understand that these can be used by that. If you suffer from the conflicted mind of jealousy, there's something that you can do. You don't have to just feel regretful that you have that. There's an antidote. And the antidote is rejoicing, which is to take delight or to be delighted or to enjoy the virtue of others, the good fortune of others. Jealousy, for example, which is the counter to rejoicing, is a combination of attachment and anger. And so Patro Rinpoche said, as I have repeated it here many times, it is the intention of the doer alone that determines whether actions are positive or negative, not the actual physical or verbal execution of that intention. For this reason, the Buddha explains in detail that simply observing the good that others have done with a pure mind, sincerely rejoicing in it, and dedicating its power to the complete enlightenment of all beings will bring more merit than ostentatious good deeds poisoned by the eight ordinary concerns. So the eight ordinary concerns in regards to a good deed, for example, might be hoping for fame, hoping for praise. The next of the seven branch prayer is the request to turn the wheel of Dharma. And not surprising, this is the antidote to ignorance. Dharma is the word used to refer to the teachings of the Buddha. It means many things. It means spiritual path or spirituality in general, instructions, Dharma instructions. And as I often mention at Dekiling, it also means phenomena, things and events. So the Dharma has three collections. The teaching Dharma has three collections. The Vinaya, which is the Dharma of discipline, and the Sutra, which is the Dharma of meditation, and the Abhidharma, which is the Dharma of wisdom. So imagine this quote, do not do anything of non-virtue, do only virtuous deeds, completely tame your mind. These are the teachings of the Buddha. So this is a kind of example of the Dharma of discipline. It's a direct instruction about what virtuous action is. So we are requesting teachers to turn the wheel of Dharma, giving us discipline, meditation, and wisdom in the right way. And I like to say, I know not everyone agrees with this view, but I like to say that we need to request this from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They will always respond to that request. It's not a situation where they might say, no, we won't give you Dharma. It's not like that. They have a vow to do that. But ours is a tradition of consent. And so you ask for teachings. You ask for the wheel of Dharma to be turned. And in your asking, it will. And you don't even need to ask for a specific teaching, though of course you can do that. But just in general, because in doing this, we're acknowledging that without the teachings, we'll have no practice, or we'll have practice, but it will be incomplete or backwards somehow. The next piece of the seven branch prayer or practice is to request enlightened beings not to pass into nirvana. and this is the antidote to wrong views. Of course, if enlightened beings remain and influence our mind stream, our hearts, if their teachings remain, then this makes it possible for us to have our wrong views antidoted by their wisdom, by their instruction, by their guidance. It's a kind of ancestral guidance. And so we invoke that by requesting them not to pass into nirvana, which is an option they have when they're enlightened. So when a being passes beyond suffering, when their physical bodies die, and then they are able to pass into this state of great liberation. And so we're admonished to request the teachers, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas who have completed their work, that we should entreat them. We should ask them to stay and work for the good of beings until all of samsara is emptied, until not even the word for suffering is known. There's a beautiful verse of liturgy that talks about the dedication of merit and doubt, the relationship of those. It's a supplication, Lama, think of us, behold us swiftly with compassion. Bless us that free of obscurations, our devotion increases. Our own mind is the Buddha, but we do not recognize it. All concepts are the Dharmakaya, but we do not realize it. This is the uncontrived natural state, but we cannot sustain it. This is the true nature of mind settled into itself, but we are unable to believe it. And so Patra Rinpoche's advice is follow the example of Manjushri by dedicating to all beings whatever merit has been, is being, and will be acquired by yourself with others. Starting with this action you're doing right now, seal the dedication with the seal of non-conceptual wisdom. Never forget, he said, to perform the dedication at the end of any meritorious act, great or small. Notice that? Great or small. No matter how small, dedicate the merit. Make that a habit that you do just throughout your day. It's a wonderful carrying practice. And then seal that dedication with the seal of non-conceptual wisdom. This is empty. This came about through causes and conditions. And then Patra Rinpoche continues, any source of merit not dedicated in this way will bear fruit only once, and then it will be exhausted. But, and this is really nice, but whatever is dedicated to the ultimate enlightenment will never be exhausted, even after bearing fruit 100 times. Instead, it will increase and grow until perfect Buddhahood is attained. So there you have a kind of simple explanation of the 7-branch prayer. And as we read that, for example, in the Green Tara practice, and we go by it so quickly, you're meant to feel the robustness, the fullness, the variety, the key parts of all of these various practices. And of course, if you only think of those as you're reciting it at breakneck speed, in a puja of some kind, you know, a service of some kind, it won't be very effective. So from time to time, pull out a book, read something about the 7-branch prayer. And when you're doing prostrations, think, oh, this is the part when I say refuge and bodhicitta prostrations, this is what I'm referring to. And just continue to think like that.